know I'm an alcoholic.
I know.
It's good to be here. My sobriety date is August 17th, 1982, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys had the greatest gift bag baskets of any conference I've ever been to. When you speak, they give you a basket. And this one had everything in it. It had all kinds of stuff. But there were two objects in the basket I wanted to comment on. A fly swatter and a water pistol. Now, I was wondering what to do with those. Was I going to give them to someone? What was I going to do with a fly swatter and a squirt gun? And I realized they were preparing me for after I talk. So anybody that comes up to give me any trouble, I'm going to use the fly swatter or the squirt gun. I'm surprised to be invited anywhere, even sober this long. I quit caring about my reputation in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time ago and hit bottom with speaking at 15 years of sobriety. And somewhere in there's a message. By its nature, speaking and carrying the message and working with others are not bad things. And selfishness is not always a bad thing. And alcohol is not a bad thing. If you're new or you've been around for a while and you still hate alcohol, you probably haven't had a spiritual awakening. But if you've had a spiritual awakening, thank God for every drop I ever drank. Because it brought me to God, it brought me to you. I didn't get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You showed me how to stay sober. I got sober in a motel room in Denver, Colorado, and didn't know why I was sober that morning because I didn't want to be. But I'll get to that. Nice drive from I'm from Santa Monica, which is different than L.A. Not quite Los Angeles. It's its own republic. They even call it the Republic of Santa Monica. And when Santa Monica starts to get a little small, and I forget Los Angeles and that whole area is not the real world, it's always great to go somewhere where there's people. I didn't get sober in L.A., and I've had a hard time in 17 years there of adjusting, but it's a fun place. It's a fun place if you want to be busy. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you could tell your story, and you've all heard them all if you've been around. I could tell you an emotional story if I had emotional problem. I don't have emotional problems. And I didn't before I got here. Because I had a solution to those emotional problems. But there was still something missing. I could tell you a mental story, but there's not much left there. I have to depend on something other than reason and logic nowadays. And that's intuition. And can you do that? Can you get past your own personality? You know, when they say principles before personalities, they don't always just mean yours. And they don't always mean people. If I put my message or my way of doing this above the principles in that big book, I'm violating that tradition. Because those steps in that book are the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. It tells you in step 12, these principles. And it doesn't mean the short version. They're already short enough in how it works. But these people that take those steps and put one word on each one of them, whoever came up with that? I mean, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me when I'm new, I can't even differentiate the true from the false. But these people that break down the steps and make them even smaller put honesty for step one. I can't do that. I can't do that. The steps brought me to a power that gives me the power to practice principles I knew a long time ago. Are there any principles in this program that you didn't know about as a kid? We were not raised by animals. It's good to be honest. It's good to be unselfish. But the needed power wasn't there. Nicky was right on. Strange language. He might speak in a strange language that they call English, you know. He might even use some language we don't like. But I wonder sometimes why we've gotten so sensitive. We're so sensitive nowadays, we've become sensitive to even words. You know, piss can be either piss or beer. He said he knocked up a lady. He was talking about knocking on her door. In Australia, I said, I'd be pissed too if I was drinking piss, because they drink piss and they get pissed. That's drunk. Piss is drunk. You got to have an open mind. The first prayer that I was ever given on the first day that I met my sponsor, 6 months sober, was to pray to God. When he heard my story, he shook his head. He said, "Dear God, you know enough about yourself, alcoholism, and how you feel to be dangerous to yourself and everybody around you. Why don't you say a prayer for an open mind and a new experience?" And that prayer works. I'd like to tell you a few things that I'm not. Sometimes if you tell people what you're not, they can learn more about what you really are. I'm not an alcoholic with a choice today, because I didn't come here with one and I gave my will to God. My will is to drink. You give that to God. There is no more choice to drink today than there was to not drink before I got here. Because in a fixed spiritual condition, if you believe you have a choice today, that's the insanity of alcoholism that every one of those guys and women in that book experienced before they took the first drink. I'm not an alcoholic that can smash his own ego. If I could smash my own ego, I wouldn't be here this weekend. I'm not an alcoholic that can just not drink no matter what. Because no matter what, I drank. If I could just not drink no matter what, smash my ego and work on my character defects and shortcomings, I'd be in Santa Monica with a place where you would come to visit me. An ashram or a temple or a retreat center or something. I didn't wake up this morning and choose not to drink. I'm glad to say to you, I have not gone 23 years waking up every day, one day at a time, not drinking. Because I don't think our founders meant we don't drink one day at a time when they wrote one day at a time. I think they said, you quit drinking for good knowing you live life one day at a time. I can't smash my ego. I can't bring about my own surrender. I can't remove my character defects. And like one of the guys in Denver where I got sober, they used to say to me, you know, at the third step, if you would have had something to do with your own creation, wouldn't you have done a little better job? And I actually thought I would have done a little better job if I had something to do with my own creation. But I didn't. Because I suffer from a problem much worse than drinking, described in our big book. Lack of power. But lack of power is only a dilemma when you want to do something. A lot of people had problems with my drinking before I did. But when you finally want to do something, then you find out about lack of power. Even in sobriety. You either need some power or you got some power. I think the deal for me, since I was about a year sober, in my first set of amends, where having power is also a dilemma. What does having power entail? Nelson Mandela wrote a wonderful poem about, after 26 years in prison, about being more afraid of the light than you are of the dark. Being more afraid of real power than you are of remaining powerless and irresponsible. The men that talked to me didn't say they were 15, 20, 30 years sober and they were still powerless and their lives were unmanageable. Why would anybody new want that? And if I'm still powerless over alcohol, how come I'm not drunk? Something came between me and alcohol 23 years ago. And I've been given power to manage my life. And I make mistakes. That's the risk. All you have to do around here is risk being an asshole. Risk being wrong. We don't like that. And we don't like responsibility. And we don't like the idea of having power. All those things Mickey said, that book says. We've been given the power to help others. We can do things that no alcoholic can do. We can go places alcoholics shouldn't even go. I would suppose if I was to say we are all in the exact place we're supposed to be today, doing exactly what we were supposed to be doing, most of you would agree. See, I think I'm somewhere I absolutely shouldn't be doing something I absolutely shouldn't be doing. Because right now, in this moment, I care about somebody else. And that's not what my life is like. I work in Vegas. I dealt cards. I shouldn't be in there. But that's not my problem. Did drugs? That's not my problem. But I am an alcoholic, and the first step is very important to find out what your power is over so you don't start a spiritual process with a fundamental lie. When I was new in AA, we used to take these guys out of basements that were strung out on drugs, take them to a treatment center on the way, buy them a pint of whiskey, pour it on them, pour it all over them, have them drink some, and check into the treatment center to tell them that you're an alcoholic and that you drink, so they would accept your insurance. And they would start their recovery on a fundamental lie because they're not powerless over alcohol. And I was so fortunate to meet a man that knew the difference between drug addiction and alcoholism, because they're not the same. And I used to try all these complicated things to explain that to someone. Put 100 addicts in a cabin, shoot them with him, put 100 drinkers in it. It doesn't make any sense. All you got to do is talk to enough addicts, real addicts, who could take or leave alcohol. And then you got to talk to enough real alcoholics to see that there's alkies that can take or leave drugs. Now, I'm powerless over where drugs take me. But I got to tell you, I did a lot of drugs, but one day I woke up and I said, I'm never doing cocaine ever again because I hate the way it makes me feel. And I never did cocaine ever again. And I couldn't quit drinking. And real addicts don't understand me. Had a couple bouts with heroin. Woke up one day, I didn't say I hate the way heroin makes me feel. Anybody that hates the way a heroin makes you feel is an idiot. I said, I hate where that drug takes me. It gets me in trouble. Never did it again. Couldn't quit drinking. So by the textbook definition, I'm a hard drug user that's a real alcoholic. I'm powerless over where drugs take me, but not like a real addict. And we need that common bond. We were a little concerned, and I think some changes were made because of people like some of you in this room and people that wrote letters. Because in this fourth edition, they said a meeting online is the same as my home group. This is not my home group, but this is a lot better than a meeting online. You know why? Because I can see out his eyes. I can see you. You ever spoke at a candlelight meeting and you can't see anybody and it just doesn't feel right? See, because if I went online for a meeting, I certainly wouldn't be, my name's Joe, I'm 53 years old, overweight, smoke cigarettes, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. I would have a different name, a different age, probably a different sex, and I would get more attention online than I probably would get today. I think it happens right here, one alky with another. See, because I didn't know what I was when I got here. And I lived with a question that I've lived with at different times in sobriety, too. What's wrong with me? And I know maybe it's not the new guy, or maybe it is. Or maybe it's somebody with 7 years, or 14 years, or 25 years, and you're wondering. I've done everything they've asked me to do. And I'm dying inside. The book describes it well. See, I don't have a two-fold disease. A lot of alkies in this program think they got a two-fold disease. That's not what I have. I have a disease that was in full bloom before I ever took a drink. It's a threefold disease. My book says I'm not only bodily and mentally ill, those are just the symptoms. I am spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, I begin to straighten out. So what's a spiritual malady? I mean, if you're new and you hear someone say spiritual malady, I mean, the word spiritual isn't even really popular in our society, especially in mental health fields. They don't even recognize the human spirit. But how did that feel when I was young? It feels like you're shut off, separate, like a distinct entity. When I read the doctor's opinion the first time and he said that a part of my disease separates me and differentiates me like a distinct entity. You know what that fit? That fit a daydream that I used to have before I ever took a drink. We're talking 10, 11, 12 years old. And the daydream was a spaceship was going to land in my parents' backyard. And a little green man was going to get out. And he was going to say, we brought you here to this planet as a teeny baby. It was a test. You failed and we're taking you home. But that spaceship never landed. and I felt different and separate and out of place in a family where I really had to come up with some excuses to be sick when I first got here. I heard people say they were alcoholic because they were abused. I wasn't. I heard people say they were alcoholic because mommy and daddy were. Mine weren't. My dad was a classic textbook hard drinker. He was 60 years old when I was born. My mom was 30. In therapy, that will cause you a lot of pain. That'll be your root issue. My daddy's age when I was born, and by the time I was 10, he was 70, and he didn't play baseball with me, and he didn't do this, and he didn't do that. Now that I've woken up a little bit, his age when I was born gives me a tremendous amount of hope for the future. For those of you who didn't get that, I would like to be doing what my father was doing when I'm 60 years old. I've heard people say they're alcoholic because they grew up in poverty. You see, the disease doesn't care. And it's so funny to hear, like, lots of fist steps. Because this guy's blaming this and the other guy had that, but he's blaming the opposite. So I realized in one of my first fist steps that I had come up with a game that we don't hear talked about, but I know a lot of you had it. We hear a lot about the yet. Haven't done that yet. Haven't done that yet. I didn't have a lot of yets, but I had if-onlys. Any of you ever had, when you were new, the if-only story? If only I hadn't grown up in that town. I grew up in Battle Creek, Michigan, halfway between Detroit and Chicago. And when you grow up halfway between Detroit and Chicago, you've got to go somewhere. And that's what I was like. I was like a guy that wanted to be black who grew up halfway between Detroit and Chicago, and he was never going to turn black. But I had a dream. I had a dream. Oh, I shouldn't have said that, huh? I didn't mean it that way. I had a dream. My dream was to play drums with Junior Walker and the All-Stars in the Elgrado Lounge in Battle Creek, Michigan. I picked their drummer as my drum teacher. I played drums in the band in elementary school. And by the time I was 17, I got to play drums with my drummer teacher's band, Junior Walker and the All-Stars, at the Elgrado Lounge, high on heroin. And I was still empty. You know those times where the dream doesn't fill? And you just say, well, I got a new dream. So I was a new dream. Shit. I don't have a lot of dreams anymore. You know why? Because I've gotten more than I ever dreamed of in this program. What's that slogan? You'll never get what you want, but you'll get what you need. What happens when you've gotten more than you've ever needed, more than you've ever wanted, and your dreams have been surpassed 10 times? Then what do? Keep praying for what you need? Jeez. I could tell you a geographical story of my sobriety. I spent my first five years in Denver, 10 years in Santa Monica, 5 years in northern India, and 3 years now back in Santa Monica. That doesn't tell you much. I could tell you what it was like, because nothing had happened, and there ain't nothing that's different now. A lot of people think the big book says I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The problem with me, it's always outside of me. It doesn't say that. It says I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like. And it's the same as you. And that's why it says we. What happened and what it's like now. A lot of you have been to enough of these where you hear somebody get up and they say, I'm not going to talk a lot about my drunkalog today, but... I was with one of my heroes, Mike, the director of the Denver Central office, 35 years sober at the time, Lynn, and we were in the front row at the Colorado State Convention, and one of these guys got up, and it was 55 minutes of what it was like. And my hero leaned over to me, looks a lot like you, she leaned over to me and she said, I think I want him to get sober more than his own family. And my hero said that to me. You know, and the more your sponsor become, the more your heroes become human, it sure does free you up to be human. Because I've met some amazing people in my life. Enlightened, spiritual, awake, different names they might call them, realized. But they always leave one word out when they use the term like enlightened being, spiritual being. They always leave out human. But the most spiritual people I've ever met in my life were the most human people I ever met in my life. So growing up in Battle Creek, Michigan, with everything you could ever want to grow up right. My sister didn't have alcoholism, lived in the same house. So much for the family messing me up. My two brothers, well-adjusted, healthy, had left the house by the time I came along. But I had this emptiness. And I'd have to find something out here to put the blame on. Well, if your dad was 70 by the time you were 10, you'd understand. And if you'd gone to that school they sent me to, you'd understand. And I always wanted a life that made sense to you. And it never made sense to you. Today I have a life that makes sense to me. And I didn't know that's what I always wanted. You know, my life today doesn't make sense to a lot of people. Get up and leave Santa Monica, 15 years sober, living in a great apartment with a wonderful income, helping people, home group. Because of an invitation from somebody that has what I want, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. And you know how far I went? To India. I went for a couple month visit. Stayed 5 years. If that doesn't tell you I'm alcoholic, nothing else will. We come early, we stay late. We stay way past our welcome. Right? So growing up in Battle Creek, all I can tell you from like 1 to 13 is emptiness, lonely, scared, baffled with that question, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I set out to find out the answer to that question. I believe my drug and alcohol use and my alcoholism were a spiritual search. I believe, and I don't want to get into a debate with anybody, I believe God used alcohol to bring me back to Him. And He moves in mysterious ways, and He uses a lot of mysterious things and a lot of strange people. You know, who's done more work than the devil for God? He brought a lot more people to God than virtue. So at age 12, their question changed and my question changed. They used to say to me, you remember them, whoever them are, that guy, that man, that voice, that woman that's in your head you're always answering to. They used to say to me, you have so much potential and opportunity. And your dad will give you his business. And you'll be set for the rest of your life here in Battle Creek, Michigan. My God, I was 10 years old and that wasn't attractive to me. I hadn't even taken a drink. I hadn't even woken up yet. Then when they used to say, you have so much potential, I used to say, what's wrong with me? And where is that potential? Then when they stopped saying you had so much potential, I had finally found a solution, and they started saying, what's wrong with you, when I was finally right. When I finally found a solution that propped me up out there, allowed me to say whatever I wanted to my dad, kick my sister's ass, ask the little girl at the dance to dance, and if that's not finding power in a practical way, I don't know what is, because she wouldn't dance with me the week before because I didn't ask. And I couldn't ask because I didn't have enough power. Because I didn't find alcohol yet. But a week later, I went outside with some guys and drank some Boone's Farm apple wine. I went back in that dance, and I danced. And when you live halfway between Detroit and Chicago and you can't dance, you don't do nothing else. You got to dance. So I took a drink at age 13. And it wasn't needed, necessary, right. It wasn't in the right environment. It wasn't a good idea. The two little guys that I drank with puked and went home. One daddy told him, if you drink ever again before you're 21, you won't get my jewelry business. The kid never took a drink until he was 20. If that's not alcohol insanity, I don't know what it is. See, I think alcoholic insanity is someone that takes a half a drink and leaves it. I can be in a room. There's a restaurant I like to go to in Los Angeles about this big, seats 1,000 people, and they serve Chinese dim sum. And I watched somebody once, they must have been like way over there, and they left a half a drink. I don't notice people drinking, but I notice people abusing alcohol. And that's abuse. That's abuse. Or my mom would say, I had 3 drinks and I started to feel it and I didn't want anymore. And you go, my God, what's wrong with you? That's the point. Or several years later, the guys in the penitentiary would say, you can't drink the spud juice when it blows up the first time. It'll make you blind. And I would say, bring some on. That's what my goal. I want to be blind. I don't want to see. I don't want to see. The penitentiary is not a great place to be awake. I did LSD in the penitentiary once. Ooh, that was a trip. I saw my future and it didn't look good. Never did LSD again until I got out. That's power. That's choice. This whole thing for me is about choice. You either got a choice or you don't. If you don't have a choice, you're welcome here. But if you think you got a choice, you're still welcome here, but you might find out you do. And you might find out you don't. They were talking about pumping Al-Anons earlier. I was engaged to one once. I got pumped. No. She came to our group 7 years sober. There's a message in this story. She came to our group with 7 years of sobriety, in AA, feeling a little off. I find, and I know that our bodies also change every molecule, every cell, every 7 years, but I've had major turning points in my sobriety every 7 years. And she came at 7, and it seems a lot of common stories. Watch some of the countdowns. Watch some of the countdowns where there's the biggest spaces. 9, 8, 11, 15. And at 7, she came to our group with 7 years of sobriety, felt a little off, heard that our group is a good place to come and do those steps. Picked the strongest woman in the group. We fell in love. We made a healthy decision not to have sex for a while. She wasn't a newcomer. She was 7 years in our program. But we had both always started every relationship based on sex rather than friendship, and that's the foundation. And if sex ain't great or in a given occasion, you don't have nothing to fall back on. We made a healthy decision. And I also thought she probably needs some space to do this work. Because this work, in this book, you come out the other end not the same. My mother heard me speak in my first set of amends in Battle Creek, Michigan, and she said, you're not the same person. So she comes to our group, picks a woman, we fall in love, we get engaged, she comes out the end of the ninth step, not alcoholic. That's not a requirement for me. But she wasn't crazy about the steps anymore, and she wasn't crazy about helping people, and she found out she's a full-blown Al-Anon from daddy to every boyfriend she ever had. She got clear. She's very effective. We were sitting at dinner one night with a friend like this guy who likes to ask a lot of dumb questions, and he says to her, why do so many Al-Anons end up hanging around AA? And she looks at him with this look that I know, like, you dumb so-and-so. And she's trying to find the words that he would understand. And she says, Brian, what would you do to stay in a bar with a free tab? Because we're their drug. And a lot of them never get to that. We're their problem. We're not their problem. We're their solution. Had another fiancé, God's will number one, in early sobriety. And it's always God's will, isn't it? Until you find out it's God's will, but not quite for what you thought it was. And she's a full-blown alcoholic. Sorry, last month we went to the memorial of my sponsor, who passed away in March. We went to Denver together. And she reached a point in sobriety where she'd done some work. She was healthy. She was helping women. And she started to go with healthy motives to Al-Anon to look at some stuff. And there's a lot to look at for any. If you love another alcoholic, there's some stuff to look at. But it took her to a place that she had to get past, because it took her to a place where she didn't know if helping you was her problem or her solution. Because our problem is their solution, and their solution is our problem. Why? I'm always thinking about me. I need to think about you. They're always thinking about you. They need to look at themselves. And she grew past that. Found out they're both the same. Everything in my life that I thought was different, so different, isn't anymore, because I reached a point in my sobriety at 15 years when I hit bottom with this, where I couldn't remember what I was thinking about anymore. No. Where I wanted to get free of my own judgment. I think that's the next layer after fear. I think the first layer for me was a lot of hate and anger, like Mickey said. Then I found out every resentment is really fear. Then I found out fear is a smokescreen to hide my agnosticism. And then I found out underneath that is a lot of judgment started coming to us. I had opinions about the program that saved me, about people in this program that care about carrying the message. My God, thank God there's a wrench for every nut in here. My God, if there was one guy with one message, he'd have so many people to sponsor. I mean, we're attracted to different things. Like Mickey said, my God, why hasn't God removed all my character defects? Because I still need some for that guy that's puking and pissing and farting. And if I'm too sensitive to those words, I better, and I would ask this. I used to have a lot of answers. I seem to have more questions nowadays. Is it possible that your reaction to some of those words that are true about alcoholism is in relationship to your distance from new drugs, from puke, from sitting with new drugs? See, you talk to some of these guys with a lot more time than I have, and they'll tell you about when people used to die right here. Now we're shielded by a lot of stuff that keeps you and I away from that reality of what it was like. If you're new and AA doesn't make any sense, great. Because you know what I found? The first place that never made sense was the only thing that worked, and everything that ever made sense, I'd graduate and move on. Isn't that strange? The first thing that never still doesn't make sense is the only thing that's worked in my life. So I picked up a drink at 13. They started asking what I'd been asking before I found a solution. I'd finally found a solution. And they start saying, what's wrong with you? We don't know what to do with you. And they sent me away to prep school in Boston. Little did they know it was the number one drug school in the East Coast, and that the chemistry teacher there worked for Ron Das and Timothy Leary at Harvard University, and he was their chemist, and he made 50,000 hits of LSD a month, and I was one of the two students at that school that got to try his LSD. And from Boonstar 9 to LSD 25 on a sugar cube is a psychic change. I still stutter just mentioning that shift in my life. There's nothing like coming home and sitting with your parents at dinner after your first LSD trip. Or during your second LSD trip with your best friend at the table, this table where my mom would ring a bell and a black woman would come out of the kitchen and my friends would just freak. And I thought that's the way it was. And I wanted what the maid had more than my dad. And my first love was Mexican because her family had something mine didn't. And I wanted to be black and play drums with Junior Wells. I just don't want to be me. Except when alcohol was working. Then I was beyond me. It took me beyond me. It took me spiritus e spiritum. I think Carl Jung wrote that to Bill Wilson. Spirits bring you to spirit. Thank God, they're only one letter off. And I believe in that bottle I was looking for God. And I believe through that bottle I found you, and then I found God. But it took you to answer some questions that were blocking me from ever finding anything. And one of those questions was, what's wrong with me? So I go off to prep school. Have you ever wondered about this slogan? My worst, I don't even know how it goes, it's so ridiculous. My worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. What kind of alcohol did you all drink? I had some fun. I had some great days drinking. I had the greatest days of my life until I found you people. And I've had some days in sobriety that have been pretty dark. And you were always there. And one of the main things in AA is I've never been alone with any problem I've ever had in sobriety. There's always someone that can say, I'm sorry. I've been there. And I didn't know that's all I needed, because in jail, and I went to 10 treatment centers, they used to parade people by you that had a solution. But the first thing you'd say is, he hasn't been where I've been. He doesn't know how I feel. Or the guys that do know how you feel never had a solution. If being with people with a common problem was the answer to my problem today, the county jail would have worked the first time. See, we're not just people with a common problem. And I agree with Mickey. I believe the new person is very, very important. They're like the blood of this program. But if that blood doesn't have a heart to flow through, and they don't have someone in that room with a solution, if there's no heart in that room, if there's no recovery, that blood just spills all over the floor and it ain't nothing but therapy. With people that don't understand, but we have people that understand. And those are my heroes. And they understood a guy that suffered from lack of power, and that the general philosophy in Alcoholics Anonymous that's gotten away from Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you ever felt alone in AA? When somebody says, I just choose not to drink today. I just drink no matter what. I just don't drink no matter what. I just work on my character defects, smash my ego, and surrender. No big deal. And you go home and you're wondering, am I in the right program? These people are like overachievers. They got a lot of power. I didn't. If you're new and they tell you things like, don't worry, but then they'll say something like, you just have to change everything. And you feel overwhelmed by that because every therapist's office and every treatment center you ever left, they told you you were the one that was going to have to do it. My God, the first therapist that said to me, why don't you look at therapy like a fourth step and it's truth that needs to go to God, you still need the power to change. It changed my whole thing about therapy. When I met a man that didn't put the responsibility on me, he knew I was the healee rather than the healer. Right? So I had 7 years of fun. Went to Woodstock, was a hippie, lived on a commune in Colorado a couple summers. Bought 50,000 hits of mescaline one time and drove from Battle Creek, Michigan to Vancouver, British Columbia to Guadalajara, Mexico, and back to Boulder, Colorado. There's nothing more fun in the world than that. Except maybe driving from Santa Monica to Laughlin. Is this one of those communities where you say it's not really hot here? It's a dry heat. Right? Or how about this one? I lived in Texas for a few months in the treatment field for the third time, that insanity, a couple of years ago when I came back from India. And guys in Texas would actually say things like, is it hot enough for you? And you'd want to say, no, I'd like it to be, I'd just like to be melting right here, you know? Is it hot enough for you? Right? So I had 7 years of fun. And by age 19, they put me in the Michigan State Penitentiary. I didn't choose that. I've been bought out of 2 felonies by Daddy. Armed robbery and a sale of marijuana when sales of marijuana was 20 to life. And by the third one, Daddy was dead. I went in front of the judge and he said, your dad's dead. He's not getting out of this one. Bang, 3 to 5 years. And that was for forgery. I cashed $55,000 worth of checks from him that weren't mine. And that was a busy week. There were $136 payroll checks. That was a busy week. I'd like to say I had a lot of memories about that week. But I don't. But I do know the end of the week. See, I used to think of blackouts as time travel. Doesn't it sound a little better than the blackout, right? You ever heard these speakers that get up and say, I'm a blackout drinker, and then they tell you detail for detail for detail of their drinking. I heard a guy one time, another one of my heroes, he said, my drinking's like a pile of piss. And once in a while, some truth bubbles up to the top. I was like, woohoo. That's where I got sober. I got sober with guys and women in Denver, Colorado that cared more about whether you lived or died than how you might feel about what they had to say. They risked your sensitive alcoholic feelings for the truth. Shit, my sponsor was pretty gentle. Well, you probably moved on, P, from Denver. And I said to him once, I'm afraid of my own mind. He said, you have a lot of good reasons to be. I said to him once, I feel terribly inferior and insecure. And don't you hate these answers? His eyes lit up. He said, you want to know why you feel inferior and insecure? I said, yeah, I've been looking for the answer to that my whole life. He said, because you're inferior and insecure. Let's move on. That's too simple for a guy like me. It's got to be heavy. It's got to be complicated. It's got to be meaningful. It can't just be that I feel inferior and insecure because I'm inferior and insecure. Why? Lack of power. I had to find a power by which I could live. God, this power came between me and Bruce way before I knew how to live. You guys taught me how to live by example. I got several guys in Denver that would say stuff like, "The way you live makes so much noise, you don't need to talk about this book." Or, "There's a difference between a chicken and a pig." Well, what does that have to do with me? That's because I was in their meeting and I had the nerve to say, I turned it over and I took it back, and I turned it over and I took it back, and this old boy, Don says to me, "If you're still doing that, you haven't turned it over. Third step's just a decision. But the commitment that follows the third step is a big deal." And I said, I learned to ask the greatest question I could ever learn to ask in Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you mean? If you're new and you really want to find out something interesting, the next 10 times somebody says, "Turn it over," go up to them and ask them, "How do you turn it over?" Overall, keep coming back. "So how do you turn it over?" "Well, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth." You know? See, I can show someone precisely how to turn it over. But it ain't my way. You make a decision. I came to believe in God the same way I came to believe in booze. Ah. You can come to believe in God the same way you came to believe in booze. How did I come to believe in booze? Did you ever come to believe in booze sitting across the street from a liquor store? Did you ever come to believe in booze studying a book on what it would be like to believe in booze? What did you have to do? You had to make a decision, take some action, walk across the street, buy a bottle, take some action, and then you got some results. And then you had faith. More faith than I ever had in anything or anyone ever. Anyone that ever got in the way of my drinking? History. I never understood guys that said, "I went to jail, I couldn't drink." My God. But there was no choice. When you gotta have a drink, you gotta have a drink. I care if it's mouthwash. I care if it's spud juice. Right? So I said, I turned it over and I took it back, and he said, "The third step's just a decision, but the commitment." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It's like a chicken and a pig. Walking down the street and they come to a sign on the church that says, 'Help feed the poor.' The chicken looks at the pig and he says, 'We got to do something about that hunger problem.' The pig says, 'What in the world can we do?' And the chicken says, 'We could feed those poor hungry people ham and eggs.'" The chicken says, "For you that's just a simple decision to lay some eggs, but for me that's one hell of a commitment." So we kind of AA, and our group, we call it Hokey Pokey AA. Nothing worse than being in AA on the fence. And there's people with time that are still wondering, "Am I? Aren't I? What's wrong with me?" So I had 7 years of fun, 7 years of trouble. And then I fled Michigan to Las Vegas, Nevada, into the arms of a man that I was loved more than my own father. His name was John Burkhart, and he lived in Henderson, and they were heroes in that town. This guy was so tough. He had been in a car club before the Hells Angels, before his 2 terms in Vietnam, and he ended up in Battle Creek, Michigan. And a guy like that was like, "Do you know John?" "No." "Well, you better meet him." And 4 of us met him, and we were 17, and he was 34. And he had 4 of us put one of these stars on our hand. Rusty was asking about it today. A little star on my hand. They're all dead. I'm the only one alive. So I fled from Michigan to Las Vegas into his arms. That's a whole other story. And he took me in. And I went to dealer school and I worked downtown. We went camping one weekend and came home feeling fresh. And his wife said, "Wouldn't it be nice to shoot some dope just once? We're clean." Having me clean was just drinking like a pig. That was clean. And sober. why don't we get some dope? And I said, I got the money. He said, I know where to get it. And I paid for the drugs that killed him. He died in my arms of a drug overdose. And I had to live with that until I was 3 years sober. And in amends, 3 years sober, I had probably been to Vegas 6 times sober. I could not go to Henderson to his grave. And on my 3rd birthday, you see, don't let anybody tell you you can't have fun in sobriety. You get some power in your life, you can go places alcoholics aren't even supposed to go. My 3rd birthday, in Vegas, at Caesars, full pump, 3 friends, sober, having fun. I woke up on my 3rd birthday, and my intuition said, you're going to Henderson today to his grave, and there was no way. I'd made amends to his brother, his sister, his mother, his father. I made amends to him through a letter, and there was still something there. I wasn't free. And I think the proposition, if you've been around here for a while, is how free do you want to be? You'll hear somebody in a meeting share about going to any lengths to make amends, and you're not even willing to fly to Des Moines, Iowa, and he went to Israel, and they laugh at him if he gets free. So I went to his grave, no fight, no resistance, walked up to it like it was yesterday, got down on my knees, said what I was supposed to say, and looked down. I was there on the date of his death, and it was my sobriety date, just different years. I can't pull that off. Any of you that have ever been in amends with any kind of heart and awake at all have had those experiences. Pull up to a red light, there's somebody you never thought you'd ever find again. I think when you get to the 9th step, if you've been thorough in 1 through 8, the whole universe opens up for you. And things that you thought could never be repaired. How do you repair a relationship with a mother that got to the point where you're talking through a plate glass window on a phone in the Michigan State Penitentiary? I can't do that. God can and will, if you seek Him. If you just seek yourself and your own relief, and you think sobriety is about finding comfort, you'll just become somebody that worships comfort, like I did at 15 years, and your philosophy will go like this. If it feels good, it's good, and if it feels bad, it's bad. And that's a dangerous trap, because I tell you what, writing full-column inventory is not always comfortable. Making amends is not always comfortable. But you risk that comfort, and on the other side, there's freedom like I never had. My 2 most kind, don't ever let anybody tell you you can't make amends to someone who's dead. There'll always be people around you trying to sell God and this program short, and I don't see any difference between the two anymore. I remember an old boy in Texas, and he said to my friend Mark Houston, when Mark said he had gone to every amends that he was currently aware of, that he was current. And this old boy says, the idea that you can finish amends is like thinking you could go to the Empire State Building, open a feather pillow, let him go, and go find all them feathers. And my friend didn't even think. He said, what if you had a personal relationship with the creator of each of those feathers? Could he take them to you? I don't know. And those are the 3 hardest words for an alcoholic like me to say. Someone told me once, the 3 hardest words for an alcoholic are, I love you. They didn't drink like I did. I sit between a Republican and a Democrat. I can convince both of them I love them if I'm drinking. Right? So I had 7 years of fun, 7 years of trouble. He died in my arms. I flew to Key West, Florida. Had 7 years of death. And I couldn't even pull that off. See, I'm a failure at living and I'm a failure at dying. We're just the ones that failed at that. I love when I hear Alki's talking about we're the chosen ones. Chuck C. used to talk about we're the ones that haven't paid our ticket yet. We're still the ones that are paying our dues. They got free. They got to go. Right? Obviously, the people in this room's job's not done yet. And what's our job? My job is to show another alcoholic precisely how to recover. Because that's the first promise in the first foreword of the first edition of the first book, and not one of them had more than 5 years, and they told us not only could you recover. I don't suffer from the symptoms of alcoholism today, but I do have to take the root of that disease to God on a daily basis. And the root of that disease is a spiritual malady that I still have. And the spiritual malady is when you're feeling blocked off. When you reach 7 years and you got areas of your life that have just blossomed and changed, but you feel like you're up against a new wall. And you can't quite push your way through it. And that's when I got free of the philosophy. You do the first 9 steps once and you live the rest of your life in 10, 11, and 12. That's like giving somebody 12 pieces of piano music and say, play 9 of them once and practice the last 3 the rest of your life. They won't be very good at the first 9. They won't have gotten the first 9. And my experience with 1 through 9 at 22 years sober was a lot different than at 20 or 15 or 11. I give myself to this work because it works. I had to read this book until I realized how it works actually means how it works. I have a master's degree in psychology. I've been to 7 colleges, and it took me a long time to realize they mean what they say. That there is a solution actually means there is a solution. So, I had 7 years in Key West, and I had more knowledge than power. And there's nothing worse in life than knowing more than you're able to do. And I had become a therapist. I had been in 10 treatment centers. I had worked in treatment drinking with the director of the program that I worked for. I had learned more, and I had a head full of AA before I found AA. And that's just knowledge about myself, and I had no power to do anything with it. And you know what I had to do to leave that Key West, Florida? Because it became perfect. It was waking up drinking, walking down one street to the beach, watching the sunset, and making it back home or not making it back home. And I was in heaven, and I had credit, and they knew I had money, and I had guys that would follow me to Western Union once a month, and I'd pay them off. I would trick myself with things like, you think you could go 2 months without 1 cent in your pocket and get everything you want? And I just knew so much, but I had no power. And I had to trick myself to leave Key West. Tried to leave 5 times. I'd make it to Miami. I'd walk into a bar. I'd spend my money. I'd go back to Key West. The lack of power was a dilemma because I wanted to do something. Finally. And the way I tricked myself was I ripped off everybody I knew in Key West, and on one day I ripped off the right guy, a Cuban. I wish I would have known that I had to go back to him sober and make amends. Oh, you don't do that. No, you don't do that. I went and did that, and he was sober in AA, and he brought Joe and Charlie down to Key West. You don't know. I can't make that amends. I could never find them. He's dead. You can still get free. And I tricked myself to leave Key West, and I flew to Denver, Colorado, to the last friend I had. I'd known him since I was 7. And he said, you can stay with my fiance and I, but he'd made a commitment to her not to drink. And I didn't want to drink. And I said, great, I don't want to drink. And 2 weeks later, she threw us both out. And he left me on a corner in Denver, Colorado, and I was 30 years old, and he said to me, I don't drink like you. I love to party, but I'm not alcoholic, and I can't stand watching you die. Left me at a corner in Denver, 30 years old, and I was more afraid than when I went into the penitentiary, and I don't know why. It was part of advanced alcoholism. And I did what I know to do, and I go to treatment. When you have a Blue Cross Blue Shield card that's good for 30 days once a year, that's where you go on vacation. Some people come to Laughlin. I go to treatment once a year for 30 days. Stayed 2 days, had to have a drink, crawled out of a window. There's nothing more degrading in my life than crawling out of a window in my pajamas from a treatment center to get a drink. And I had 8 weeks up and down the street, Colfax Avenue, East Colfax. And I had a little car, and I don't know why I thought I had to move every 2 or 3 days. I wasn't doing drugs. I walked away from drugs. It was me and a bottle. That's all I wanted every day. Remember that feeling when you'd get the bottle, you'd actually start feeling better before you got any of it down? You got it in the car next to you. And one day, about 8 weeks after that stint, that 2 days in treatment, I woke up and I had a spiritual awakening, but I didn't know it was a spiritual awakening. And sometimes a spiritual awakening will scare you. Because I woke up August 17, 1982 in a hotel in Denver, and for the first time in 18 years, I couldn't drink. It scared me. And you know why it scared me? I had no reason like I used to put my finger on. There was no screaming landlord, no screaming woman, no screaming judge, no parole officer, no mother, no father, and I couldn't pick it up physically, mentally, emotionally. And I wasn't any sicker than the day before, and I'd love to tell you I did something the night before that brought that about. And I think it's God's grace that I haven't remembered that I did anything different the night before. I also think blackouts are God's grace, and they'll be revealed on His time. I think if we had to see it all at one time, and I woke up and I didn't know what to do, so I called the treatment center back. They said, "You can come." The director got on the phone. He said, "You know, when you left after 2 days, we found out about you. And we know how many treatment centers you've been to. We know you've been a therapist in treatment. And if you come back, it's going to be on our terms and on our turf." And I was in that state of being that I still get to experience 23 years sober sometimes. And that is, whatever God has in mind for me is better than anything I have in mind for me. And I was willing to do anything. And I went back there, and you know what they said? You can't talk to anybody during business hours from 8 until 5. You cannot go to group because you'll be running in a week. And you can talk to one person, and he's your therapist, Father Felix. He's a monk in a monastery at night and a therapist in the field during the day. And he knows everything about God and nothing about therapy, and you know everything about therapy and nothing about God. We were perfect. I left that treatment center, and they had a big room, and all the people were there, and they were going to give me a diploma and a big book. Nothing funnier if you still have a book that you went to treatment with. If you can find a book where people signed it, it is some of the funniest stuff you'll ever read in sobriety. Because 2 years later, no one that signed my book was still sober. And I would read it, and there's things like, "We became so close while we were here in treatment. We'll walk the happy road of destiny for the rest." All we did was make love in a broom closet one day, and we were going to be lovers the rest of our life. And they didn't give me a graduation. I'm all ready for the graduation. The director walks in the room, and he says, "We're not giving you a graduation because we don't think there's much hope for you because you don't do real well with booze, and you're not doing really well without it. See ya." Thank God for that man, because you know what? It was the first time I left treatment with no hope. And what are they going to do nowadays? Nowadays, they're going to give you a relapse prevention plan of what you can do to keep yourself sober before you come here. And we say, there's nothing we can do to keep yourself sober. My relapse prevention plan always involved drinking as a prevention to relapse. Because there is a state of consciousness that I hate more than any state of consciousness ever, and that's sober. Without a solution. Sobriety, or whatever you want to call it. And I have an 18-year and 23-year history in AA to prove to you that an untreated state is an intolerable situation. It describes it in here in very practical terms, that spiritual malady. You're restless. You're irritable. You're discontented. You cry at hockey games and laugh at funerals. That's one of my sponsors threw in there. And on page 52 in the chapter to the agnostic, if you want to know, I don't care how long you're sober. I ain't scared with people with time anymore. If you get sober in Denver, you're far downhill after that. I've met the scariest guys. Right? If you're wondering at 7 years why you're feeling a little stuck, 11 years, 14 years, go back to the solution that was provided the first time, if you've ever done it. Get current. The steps will meet you where you are. This is one of those books you can look at it as deep or as simple as it meets you for where you are now. And I would like anybody to show me where our founders or anybody wrote in our literature that the first 9 principles were only meant to be practiced once. You read the letters of Dr. Harry Keeble now that you've been around. Unfortunately, it's no longer AA literature. And you got to look for it to find it, usually from Hazleton. And read what Dr. Harry Keeble wrote about the dry drunk syndrome or the reconstruction of the ego and why repeated work with 1 through 9 is so very important. I've watched men and women in this program wake up at 26 years, 25, 12, 15, 30. A lady in Toronto named Mildred that I correspond with on a regular basis, I encouraged her through the work once. I went back to Toronto 2 years later. She said, "I did all the things you asked me except one amends." And all I asked her the rest of the weekend, "Why isn't that one done? Why isn't that one done? Why isn't that one done?" Because the difference between me, my consciousness, the day before I still had some unfinished amends, where I haven't at least gone and begun, doesn't mean they're all paid. I've made my approach. Some have been lifetime. But you've made the approach. The difference between the day before the last one that I'm consciously aware of and not being aware of any, and experiencing a day where you're current, you might get free of the idea that you're working the steps to the best of your ability. The best of my ability is to be glued to a bar stool downstairs, screwing people over, not caring about anybody else. I can't even get to the truth in the first step on my to the best of my ability. I can't even answer the question, what's wrong with me? But because of people like you and people like Don who sat down with me, the experience in these steps answered that question I lived with my whole life. I know what's wrong with me. I have a threefold disease, body, mind, and spirit, that can only be treated through a spiritual awakening. I've had that spiritual awakening, and I still seek a deeper relationship with that power. I had 5 great years in Denver, and if I would have known that was the only time I was going to get in Denver with those people at that time, I would have done a lot more. But I take things for granted. If I would have not known the last time I saw my sponsor face to face that it was going to be the last time, that's the difference. I knew. You get to wake up. You get to wake up and look around. It's like this town. This time you drive up over the hill, you're in the middle of nowhere, and boom, there it is. It's just out there. There's just sun. There's no place to hide. And when you wake up, you don't want to hide. And then I had 10 great years in Santa Monica, and I learned about working with others. I learned about working with lunatics. I learned about working with people that had that same question, and every one of them were just like me. And if I think I'm any different than that new guy, I'm in big trouble. And if I think this has to do with me, I'm in big trouble. And if I think seeking God is not as a serious matter that I have more in my life than I've ever dreamed of now, see, the stakes are higher. It's like downstairs. And I don't want to gamble with one part of this program, because I met people that shared 3 parts of the program. 3 legacies that our founder gave us. Unity, recovery, and service. Triangle. It's a shame we lost that on the title page. It's a shame the big book says that a meeting online is the same as my home group. It's a shame that the inside paper cover says the first 164 pages had been a foundation for many when it used to say, is the AA recovery program. That's all sad. But all of those problems, my sponsor always encouraged me, all of the problems that we want to bitch about in Alcoholics Anonymous can be solved by one thing. Sponsorship. Clear sponsorship by people who have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Not 9.5. I believe the most overlooked word in the 12 steps is the last word of step 8. Think about that. And made amends to them all. I've met people that didn't have the luxury of meetings like we do. At every international I've ever gone to. Learners, internationals, people on mountaintops, clinics, people who don't have the luxury of a meeting every day. And they talked about what AA meant to them, and I thought, my God, they're so not distracted from our primary purpose. They talked about AA is about forming a relationship with God. It's there in the mountain clinic that you can't come down to a meeting every day. It's there in the jungle or the forest. And I wondered, why am I interested in those people? And after 10 years in Santa Monica, and hitting bottom with all of this that saved my life. Isn't that funny? Everything I ever thought besides God, everything I ever thought saved my life, I hit bottom with. And I got brought back to God. And I was hitting bottom with this stuff, carrying the message, speaking, working with others, not by its nature, by what I did with it up here in my ego. And there's nothing worse than becoming somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. To become somebody in an anonymous program is a daunting task. To stand for something in Alcoholics Anonymous nowadays is not easy. I heard a guy the other day and he said, you know, you can tell when the world is coming close to ending when the tallest basketball player is Chinese, the greatest rapper is white, the greatest golfer is black, the Germans don't want to go to war, the French think we're arrogant, and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is no longer popular in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I believe the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is popular in Alcoholics Anonymous by those that suffer from lack of power. Not by those that have a choice today. Not by those that can smash their ego. Not by those that can fix their own defects. Not by those that can just not drink no matter what, but by those that are real alcoholics who suffer from lack of power, who have a spiritual malady, really need all three parts of the program. One of the saddest things I ever heard as part of the format in a lot of states in this country is that the steps are to the individual, but the traditions are to the group. My sponsor told me about 36 spiritual principles that have benefit for the individual, and that I could practice the traditions in my life once I got some power from the first 12 principles in any area where it deals with more than one person. And that's what my life is supposed to be about today. And you gain power from the steps, you gain effectiveness from the traditions, and you learn how to work with other people through the concepts of service. And I'm so grateful for a man that didn't sell this program short, who shared all three parts of this program, a three-part disease with a three-part program with 36 spiritual principles. I'm not perfect. I made a lot of mistakes. At 15 years of sobriety, I had an experience that blew my mind. I met a guy in Australia speaking at a thing in AA, a remarkable man who invited me to come to Northern India. I thought I was going to move back to Colorado, so I thought I would go for a couple months. I stayed 5 years. I would visit home once a year. And I got to start a three-part drug and alcohol treatment program for the Tibetan government for the first time in their history. And I got to study with some amazing people. And I got to watch those people have access to our program. I got to take the first Tibetan man to ever go through our steps through the work, and he now runs part of that program. And as soon as I got good at it, God said, you got to go now. There's a war next door in India and Pakistan, 3 hours away. I stayed till the lights are off. I stayed till the last possible minute. And that drug program is still there for Indians and Tibetans and visitors, detox, outpatient, and long-term treatment. And how does a guy like me get to be a part of something like that? I'll stop now, but I want to tell you a joke that I heard not too long ago. I thought it was great. It's about the fourth column of this inventory in our process, where you look at your part. You thought your whole life they were going to get it, but you were the one that got it. And it's about a guy that's been in prison for a long time, and he thinks he's in prison because there's walls and bars, and he's got to get out, and he escapes, but he's still running and running and running. And he finds a house because he's got to get some more stuff to get further from what he thinks is his prison. Breaks into this house to get some cash and a car, and he finds a young couple in bed, and he grabs the husband, puts him in a chair, ties him up. The wife puts her in a chair, doesn't tie her up, but he leans over and he kisses her on the cheek and runs directly into the bathroom. Now the husband's a little confused, but he knows he only has maybe 1 minute to make the best pitch he can to save her life. So he says, honey, you got to figure this guy's been in prison a long time, probably hasn't been with a woman for a long time, so be strong, take one for the Gipper, and maybe you'll save both of our lives. And she's looking all confused, and she says, what do you mean? He didn't kiss me on the cheek. He says, well, what did he do? He said, well, he leaned over and said, I'm gay, where's the Vaseline? So be strong, honey. Don't fight. Maybe you'll save both of our lives. Thanks so much.